Hello everyone and welcome back to the Talking Spirits podcast. Firstly, I want to send out huge thanks to all the nice people that have been listening, supporting and sending beautiful messages my way lately. It feels very good to know that this new project is bringing hope and pleasure to you guys, and this is what we will keep up doing in the future as well. Today I'm welcoming a very special guest, the Serbian-Bosnian-French master pianist Bojan Zulfikarpašić, widely known in the Western Hemisphere as Bojan Z. Bojan is definitely one of the most profound innovators of the European jazz scene for the last couple decades, and I'm very happy that he was willing to grace us with his presence for the very in-depth, inspiring and interesting next 2 hours. We are wishing you a great ride and I will see you again at the end of the episode. Hello Bojan, welcome to the Talking Spirits podcast.
Hi Armin, it's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, likewise, it's a huge pleasure to have you as a guest and thank you for taking the time to be with me today. Amazing. Yep. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, last year, 2020, was a very unusual year. And actually for everyone, but especially so far as musicians, since the way we were used to work has changed significantly and unexpectedly. And the very important social element of traveling, playing shows, coming together with other people to work on project basically vanished within a very short time. So how did all of this affect you? And how are you right now in January of 21, after we have been in this for almost a full year?
Well, you know, there were things I could have imagined. I have a quite vivid imagination. But truly, this one slipped my radar.
Yeah.
I was kind of like, uh-huh. You mean no traveling? You mean no gathering in the big halls? I mean no working. So, yeah, the thing is, like, the first information I had was that it will be for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And I do remember that, you know, at the beginning we were, all of us, well, at least me, I came here. I was in Belgrade, you know, with my mother. And my plane back was on the Monday of 16th of March, which means that I was in Belgrade when they announced the curfew, actually, like how do you call it, like extraordinary lockdown situation where they were, you know, closing the frontiers and everything. But I was, you know, I kind of got afraid that I will stay there, which definitely I would not have liked, because I mean, my life and my house is here in France. So basically, I managed to run out of Belgrade and come here with a really like a last plane or regular plane that was flying from Belgrade to Paris. And I was so happy that, you know, I started to like, okay, I'm home. Let's open the bottles. And the home was filled up with the food and nice drinks and everything. So I was kind of doing a fiesta with my own self the first evening. Second evening, I started the same, you know, and then I really had like this wind from cosmos that passed in front of my ears and told me, do you really think it's going to last only 3 weeks? And I remember like stopping with a piece of cheese from my mouth and a glass of wine and thinking like, and then the second thought that came straight out of cosmos was, don't you remember that once already the life as you know it changed completely in 3 months? That was, of course, the beginning of war in what was Yugoslavia. And then definitely I remember I took the bottle and like put back the capsule and closed it. And I started actually being much more econom than I was. And here we are almost 1 year after, with all these activities cancelled and sitting at home and trying to tell ourselves, yes, we are still creative, it's going to be better and all these things. But this is actually, it's pretty horrible when you find yourself not being able to work, you know, like you're in full health. And mostly my opinion is that, you know, what I hate the most is depending on idiots called politicians this is the worst thing for me, because these people, at least I can tell you about France, but I see that it's the case all over the place. I mean, they have simply, this entire world of politics became deprived of humanity and empathy. So the only thing that they that makes them make the rules for us is insurances, there where they will not have to pay money, or we will not be able to sue them for whatever the reason is. So that's why there is no logic in their movements. That's why they keep the concert halls closed for 3 months already here, since, you know, the last lockdown. And they keep open the public transport, the offices, and the schools. So after 3 months, well, the pandemic is continuing. And the logic is, then it means that what was closed will stay closed, and what was open will stay open. That's how you stop the thing that is continuing. So I'm actually very easily, I have to say it, you know, getting angry, because this is it's a direct attack on our survival and the survival of the ministry of profounding of, you know, spiritual. That's what the art is for, you know. It makes people feel better and become better, which is all the contrary of what watching the TV and other media does to you. So
yeah,
they decided to stop us for the sake of and then, so yeah, don't look for the logic. The logic is
not there.
It's not there.
Yeah, no,
it's definitely absent from this moment. So yeah, I'm not very fond of this moment, and I'm not fond of this entire situation.
Yeah, and especially I think the long term effects of all of it for the music business and for musicians and artists.
It's like it's quite logical that I think that going out of this situation, there will be a lot of creativity, because we're all locked, we have time, and we're all home. So, you know, automatically people are preparing new projects and being inspired and everything. But the problem is like once we will kind of reopen the concert halls, I think there will be like half of them missing.
Yeah, who's going to be there still?
Yeah, and it's a how can I call it? It's artisan, you know. It's a artistic ecocide, and the way that our dear deciders, which means this political world, feels entitled to, you know, they don't feel much concern, and I think even, well. This may not sound modest, but I don't care about this, you know. But I think that they don't like actually the world of art, because it's filled up with people who have their opinion and who open their mouth and they touch other people. They don't really like this thing. I mean, it's stupid what I'm saying, but elsewhere they would really react differently than like this. Like, you know, there is not a mentioning of artistic world in any of the speech of local politicians, and actual minister of the culture in France is just a joke, total joke. And you don't have to be very clever to see that it's been used to wipe us out.
Yeah, I mean, yes, but what you just said, you know, they don't like. Yeah, and of course, it makes sense, because every kind of arts and music, it makes people creative, and also lets them ask, brings them to asking questions.
If you know a little bit about, you know, mechanisms in this world and how they've been used, you know, without entering this zone of how do you call this complot theory, you know. Any kind of a shock was used very often by the people in power, or those who are close to power, to install the things that normally would take a lot of time.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's exactly what's happening now. You know, I don't know if they're preparing some kind of a world 3.0, or whatever, where the people will work from home, which is not that bad, you know, if it's going to pollute less. This one is not something that I would be against. But globally, you know, I don't know. If you look just who gets better and richer in this situation, well, none of them are my favorites and my friends. So.
Yeah, and it's definitely not the little men.
And little artisanat, you know, the word in French, which means the little industry, the people who are creative and who create the thing. Artistry, you know, it's as simple as this. Those who do the things out of passion, you know, they closed all the libraries, but they opened the library departments in mega stores.
Yeah.
You know? So they closed the CD departments. I mean, if there was any CD and music support shops left, they got all closed, but they opened the big ones, you know, who already are selling everything from the bike till the tampons for the menstruation. It's crazy. It's really like Amazon or Fnac here in France and Boulanger. So those who are close to governments, well, they have the, you know, their friends, and the big industry. And it's not my cup of tea, you know, already for 20 years, I'm completely out of this. I don't buy my food in these stores. I don't, you know, listen to the TV. I don't consume this thing, and I'm out of it, you know. And apparently that's something that's why I do feel really openly attacked by the decisions that are made to stop the pandemics, you know, because, man, stopping the pandemics by getting people suicide themselves. Well,
Yeah.
That's another thing.
Yeah, I can relate very much to what you're saying. So maybe, you know, we can go on to a little bit more pleasant topics. So
yeah, please do, because here I really have a hard time finding any kind of inspiration, in spite of the fact that you know, I'm using this time to do the things that I could not do for 30 some years, that I was running back and forth, you know, traveling for the concerts and everything. So yeah, I'm using this to get my health back and get better.
Yeah. So if we go back in time a little bit, how did music, if you try to remember, like to your childhood, how did music come into your life, and what was it that attracted you to music and the piano in particular?
Well, the music, I think I was lucky enough to be at the right place at the right moment. So right place was, well, being born in Belgrade. And the right time was, end of the 60s. I was born in 78 in Belgrade. Why was it a good time compared to what I know now? Is because, you know, the Tito's authoritarian regime, actually, he got senile at the end of the 60s, the first signs of senility. During the 60s, he understood that the best thing he could do for the country called Yugoslavia was to do the PR, public relations, you know, in front of the rest of the world. That's when he started bringing in the actors, you know, helping, you know, as he was quite known and accepted as an important politician, important political figure in the world. He used his position to, you know, work on the things. And then I guess, like, it was the period right after these tensions that were happening in all over Europe in 68, you know, with the, and there were tensions between students and police as well in Belgrade in 68. And coming out of this, he said, oh, let the youngs do what they want. It's not a danger for our socialist regime and whatever. So basically 70s in Yugoslavia, until he died in 81, it was really like, you know, very much inspired by British scene of these years, concerning music and arts and design and whatever, you know, all these things that I was pretty quickly attracted to. So it was a big pleasure living in what was Yugoslavia and Belgrade, especially because of the fact that music scene was super creative. So many things were happening and stuff like this. which definitely, you know, made me feel good there where I was. Now, there was an upright piano at my home, which I remember I was attracted to it by the a trick that my father was pulling on me. What he did basically is he would play, you know, I was under the keyboard of the upright piano. I was, you know, being 3-4 years old. So he would tell me like, hey, this note here, and I you know, grab one note and play one note, like ding, ding, ding. Then over this note, he would play, you know, melodies with chords. And I didn't see his fingers. And I was hearing this sound because I was like right in front of the strings. And this sensation was so strong. And I was sure that I'm the one who produces all this music, you know, just by pressing one note. And it's a trick because, you know, then when I would see the piano, and there were a lot of pianos in my friends' houses back then, because music was definitely, arts were a program of, in Tito's Yugoslavia, it was an idea that music and arts should be the part of the general education of kids and people. And it was the case. So there were pianos at people's places, very normal thing. So I would see a piano and bam, I would run to the piano and look for this magic note. So automatically my interest for this thing was woken up. And that then what happened is that I went to the school with my mother. My older brother, he was already like he was almost 2 years older, and he was playing cello. And I would go with my mother to music school, and I would see the piano in the room, the music school, and run to the piano and started doing bang, bang, bang. And then they say, oh, he looks interested in this. Why wouldn't you inscribe him in music school? And that's how it all started. And here we are, almost 50 years after, and I'm still looking for the magical note.
Yeah, I mean, from what you said about Yugoslavia, before the war, I mean, I was born in 1980 and I lived in Sarajevo until 92. So I have very similar memories, you know, in terms of value of culture and music and art.
No, if you speak about a scene in a certain period, in a certain place, that's when you see how important it is to have the witnesses. And the witness in music is what? It's recordings. So basically, it is more than important to see how much the music that was produced in the 80s and the 90s and 70s in what was Yugoslavia was so creative and so important that actually this is the music that they still listen to on most of the radios when you go there, even though we're in 2020, which means like the time has stopped. Now, is it because of the fact that the people are not as creative as they used to be? Yes, if you ask me, yes. And one of the reasons why they're not creative as much as this is because of the fact that there is no industry in the positive way of the thing, which means labels, people interested, people who are speaking about music. Music kind of was like put in the line of, I mean, any kind of other past, you know, how to pass your time. How do you call this?
Spare time activities, like.
Yeah, spare time activities, whatever. I know that there's... it's not advertisement, it's like entertainment, you know. But entertainment put on the same line as, you know, video games and stuff like this. Like, oh, I'm going to listen to some music. And then, well, then I'm actually I will play the video game because there is music in the video games as well. So, yeah, whatever. And that's why the people, they don't, you know, they're not drawn to the fact to eventually, you know, make some thing that will touch people's souls, because they will have the only way for them to get their effort paid back if the people really dig what they did, because nobody's buying sound supports anymore. So they have to get close to Coca-Cola or I don't know whichever brand will use their music and eventually give them some money for this. So that's the shitty thing And that's, I think, one of the things that explains that there is a lot of music, but, you know, it's like on, well, people just couldn't care less because the offer is too big, which makes me think that actually there is no big real quality of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry for saying, but that's
my opinion. But it's the truth, actually. Yeah, and but did you already know, like, early in your life that music would be the defining factor of your life path?
At this age, I can already tell you that music as an activity and music as a soul food has saved my life so often and pulled me out of a ditch and pulled me out of difficult situations, you know, in private life and in spiritual life, in whatever you can call, in mistakes that I made about the choices and whatever. And music definitely was there just to, you know, when I say pull me out, is to fill me up with the hope and positive energy and, pull me out of a ditch. Instead of going into the dark thoughts and everything, it made me feel like there is a reason to continue doing nice things on this planet. Not just music, but through music. I mean, this is like the one that I feel the closest to as a creator. But of course, I'm touched by so many other art forms, poetry, movies, photography, literature, you name it, food, wine, drinks. I mean, any kind of activity, human activity that can be done in artistic zone, you know, where it's really like a lot of creativity and imagination and invention. So that's where I like to operate in whatever the activity is.
Over the years of being a musician and being a pianist, you have developed a very unique style of writing music, and jazz obviously plays a role in terms of, let's say, conception, expression, and instrumentation. But your approach is quite different from, you know, from a straight-ahead jazz approach, because you combine many different musical styles, like sounds, instrumentations, and one very characteristic element is that you are also incorporating influences of the traditional music of the Balkans, but in a very own and original way. So when I think back of myself, as when I was a kid or like a teenager, I really didn't, you know, I was into rock music and metal. And for me, it was like really much later that I came to start discovering how rich and how diverse and how beautiful also the traditional music of the Balkans is. So my question would be, how did this all happen for you? Like, you know, how did you come to create such a unique style of music in writing?
Thanks for this question, because it underlines the fact that eventually one can recognize me just by listening to the music in which I'm present. I mean, which is a big, big thing for me. I think that there are two reasons. First, I started by listening to music that was surrounding me, you know, and it was mostly songs, you know, folk songs or what they call Starogradske pesme. It's like the old songs from Belgrade as a city that were sung in the bars and restaurants throughout the 19th century, in the beginning of 20th century, and you know, the music that stayed in people's heads, like the repertoire that everybody knows the lyrics and the songs, and you know, this kind of that goes on the what I mentioned, being born in Belgrade, where music was very present as a social activity. It was not like here in France, automatically closed for those who are chosen, which means you are talented. Well, you're going to go to the school and then conservatory, and it will be your activity, and it's closed from the rest of the world because around you nobody's interested actually in music, and nobody's really playing music as in any moment, given moment of the day, to accompany the beauty of the life. You know? While in my house, you know, with my parents, almost every evening there was somebody passing for dinner or for food or, you know, just together. And my family and friends of my parents would gather in the kitchen of a 65 square meters flat, which was where we lived. So yeah, I was falling asleep every evening by listening to them, because, you know, it would be like food, and like after the food was done, first thing that would happen, like pull out the guitars and open new bottles of wine, whatever. And then they would sing for 2-3 hours and just be together. And that was the activity. Like you sit together and you sing.
I have the same memory, but my parents, they were not musicians, but my father, he had a huge record collection. So my earliest childhood memories is lying under the table when they were with their friends, listening to records, listening to albums, yeah, and talking and having food, like you described. Yeah,
that's exactly what I'm saying. It was like a soul food, you know, that people needed almost every day, and it was not presented as one of the artistic activities. Like I said, you know, it was really put in the program. When I look at my primary school where I went since I was 6-7 years old, I mean, they were like in Zemun, in this part of Belgrade, they were like 4 pianos in different classrooms. It was not a music school. It was like a normal school. We had 2 music teachers. Our painting teacher was a professional painter who was doing his expositions, you know. I mean, what can I tell you else? Then, yeah, we were. So that's about this moment called the epoch in which I started being interested in music. And second thing is like I started my own musical taste. I received, when I was 6 years old, I received for my birthday a revolver of the Beatles. And that was the second shock, you know, after all the music. It was like, what the hell is this? And of course, there were no ways of getting the sheet music for this music. So, well, you don't wait longer than this, because I had an example from all these people coming to my parents' place, that a song is something, you know, they take the guitar and you find the chords and then go, that's the E dim, okay, E major 7. So, you know, like finding things by ear was most normal thing in the world. So I started doing the same. I listened to the album, then I would take the guitar and like, love me do, you know, and you just find the things by ear. So it was turning completely this classical approach in which I was as well. On my piano lessons, it was like, respect everything that is written on the paper and don't add anything. So basically that explains this double start in music, explains my eclectical taste for everything that happened afterwards. Some people, when they find themselves in jazz, they renounce on everything that they've been listening before. Some of the people, they start by jazz. And for me, coming into jazz was after, when did it happen? It was like I was 14. I mean, I was not a big fan of the aesthetics going around it, because it was not the music that was happening, you know, especially the jazz from 60s and 50s. It was not the music that was my contemporary, you know, the soundtrack of the period in which I was growing. But I did manage, through the Beatles and the Symphorock and all these bands, I mean, I did manage to listen to very early to Keith Jarrett, Chick Corea, Herbie Hancock, because it was, you know, jazz rock. And that was definitely one of the sounds in which I found myself being amazed by these sounds. You know, I was picking the tunes. But then somewhere when I was 14, 15 years, I went to Grožnjan, which is this beautiful place in Istria in Croatia. There was a jazz course, and that's where I discovered that the drummers can read music too. So this is that what you call jazz? Well, it's practical. I like jazz, because before that I already had bands where I was composing music with my brother, and we always had some drummers that would learn things by heart, and then they would forget it like right after the rehearsal, so we always had to start all over again. Yeah. Then I saw the guys reading sheet, you know, reading music, and guitar players and pianos. Okay, so it's possible to play this music just with a little information on the paper, but that little information helps you get close to the, very quickly to the, having the elements of the tune.
Yeah.
And then improvise. You. So yeah, that's definitely what gathered me in this world.
Yeah.
But I never renounced. I never dismissed the things that I was listening until that moment. I did put him on standby because I realized that I have a lot of things to learn. Then I started really listening to jazz history and everything that happened before. And that made sense because, but it just reinforced my conviction that everything I listened that touched me before, well, since I was five until the age of 14, 15, well, there was a great music too. Not all of it, but I still, so my taste was always, you know, eclectic. Then another detail. I grew up in the moment and in the jazz surrounding where imitating the others was, of course, something that was good for apprenticeship. But going on stage and playing the phrases of Herbie Hancock, Wynton Kelly, Keith Jarrett, or something, it was like, okay, you know, they would, like, everybody would turn to me and go like, okay, but play your own shit. So, and one of the reasons for this is that the schools, there were no schools for this. So it was all taught by personalities that themselves received the you know, it was like this African master and the kid relation. And this, actually, I really think that it was the best thing that was kept in jazz education for quite long, this thing of master and élève, the pupil, you know. So it's almost like one-on-one.
Old school way.
So you're learning about life, not only just about music, but you're learning, you know, about the purpose and whys. Not what, but why. And this is one of the reasons why I think that for me, I always grew up in this music. And one of the main reasons why I wanted to play it is that there was a possibility that I will eventually put my own little brick in this wall with my own vision and my own sound. And that's exactly what pulled me out of play of the idea of playing pop music or classical music, because the there what it was awaited from you mostly to repeat the thing that you have recorded or repeat the thing that was written on the paper.
Yeah, so there was no freedom.
The freedom moment was much, much less than what I could find in jazz. And, you know, this adventure of jumping in the empty space that basically exists mostly in the jazz world, that was the most exciting thing ever, you know. Being able, and then I realized that, that you know, most of the albums of, I don't know, somebody like Keith Jarrett, that he would, you know, that was his trade, you know, that he would really start the concert from the scratch with trying to have a total blank in his head and just improvise for an hour and something and make beautiful music out of nothing. So yeah, that's why I still find and recognize myself in jazz world, but as a musician or a pianist or a arranger or producer, I have no problem working in different fields of music, you know, and that's what you can still see in my opus.
Yeah, and but how did the, you know, the traditional music get connected to?
Oh yeah, that's well, you know, first I was inspired even while I was, you know, growing up in Serbia, in Belgrade, in Yugoslavia. I mean, this music was like omnipresent, but mostly in the bars, kafanas, you know, and in these places, restaurants. And it was presented as a music that was, you know, popular, but musicians who were not into this, they had to do it because that's where they could earn some money. So basically, it was always a compromise that you would play shitty music. Folk music was always designed as shitty music. But you will, that's the only thing that you could do if you wanted to make some money. If you didn't have enough power to pursue your own dreams, well, then you had to find yourself playing folk music in spite of the fact that you didn't like it. So, but there were examples of, you know, Lebi Sol, you know, the Vlatko Stefanovski and his band, and Smak, and the rock bands that I was listening to, and they were quite clearly inspired by folk music, of course, Bielo Dugme, but that was already for me. Yes, it was exaggerated. It was like too close to kitsch.
Yeah.
That I would really go for this. It was not my favorite band. Since,
I agree.
I was a kid as well.
Yeah, same.
And nowadays, I even think that it was a clear opening for what happened nowadays with the with turbo folk. Everything is turbo, you know, and everything has to have folk. And we are actually quite far from the reason why folk music existed. Now it's just a kind of a label that you put there, and people recognize something and they think, okay, this is ours. So yeah, you know, for me it was, and I was inspired by the guys who were doing it, really, by the part of their identity, the music of Lebisor, Smak, or let's go further, Lala Kovace with his Balkan Impression band, and you know, which was already one of the clear fusions between jazz idiom and folk music. Well, it's as simple as this. I was lucky to work with Vojin Draškoci. He was the bass player in this project of Lala Kovace. And he had a vision of mixing punk attitude with jazz, Charles Mingus. Anyhow, what was Charles Mingus? It was a folk music mixed by jazz idiom, jazz approach. And that's how he was approaching this thing. He would take just folk music from where he was coming from. And we were lucky, very, very lucky to come from the part of the Europe of the world where folk music is really super present, and where people really have, even nowadays, we have such a huge repertoire of the songs to sing when you get into Sevdah and you drink with friends and we start singing and there's a band coming and playing on your ears and everything. You know, things that happen when I, almost every evening when I go to Belgrade, I end up in some restaurant with music around and people singing. And when I think most of my French acquaintances and friends here, that never in their life did they imagine that they will sit in the restaurant and have a band coming and ordering the song that you will have to pay. I mean, if it happens to them, they're amazed every time they find themselves in this kind of a situation. So that's something that really is very specific, and I love it.
Yeah,
I really love this aspect of music being the part of accompanying the daily moments of the life of average guy and girl in Balkans.
In 1988, you decided to relocate from Belgrade to Paris, France. And what made you take that decision to leave Yugoslavia? And especially, why did you choose France as opposed to, let's say, the USA and New York City, for instance, which could have been a destination for someone like you? But, you know.
Well, it's a good question. I'll just make a connection with something that I already said before. So I mentioned that 70s and 80s were years where I was so happy to live there, and I had no reason to move any other place because the scene was super creative, and, you know, you could meet great guys, you could go and listen to the local bands, you know, the actual bands of that moment. I mean, I'm talking about Charles Acrobata, you name it, you know the bands that existed back then. And sorry, but that's the best thing that has happened on the rock scene, in all these years that passed since, you know. So, but then when I entered the jazz world, I did, you know, understand that there was like, on one hand, it was presented as an elite, happy few with the smaller clubs. And, you know, this music was played in for those who are les connaisseurs, I mean, as they say, you know, those who know something about it. And, well, I did like this idea too, you know, that, well, if there was something for happy few, I mean, yeah, why not? It was not a problem for me because I was touched by this music, and I was touched by the elegance and the idea of what swing was. And you know, I like hard things in life, not easy ones. So being the part of jazz, it seems like, you know, you have a lot of things to learn, and you are like dismissed by the guys that are older, like looked like a piece of shit, you know, by them because you haven't paid your dues, you know. Well, I recognize myself as a young guy that has things to learn. Okay. But then I found myself in a very small world. And it was like when I started being interested for jazz, I renounced on all the girls of my age. because I was like, what is he listening to? What is this shitty music that he's listening to now? So nobody was really following me in that direction, nor my friends that I had until then. But hey, that was the price to pay. So I was, on the other hand, I did start hanging out with older guys and even meeting older girls. And as they say in Holland, you learn on the old bikes to drive. So yeah, so it was a good experience, you know, overall. And I found myself, you know, discovering where those who were already my idols in jazz rock, like Herbie and Chick Corea, Keith Jarrett and Egberto Gismonti, Ralph Towner, Richie Byrack, and all these guys. Well, I discovered that they were, you know, they had a things that they came from, so this acoustic music from 50s and 60s and everything. But I didn't like the fact that it was a closed little, you know, thing. And somehow, but I did bite this thing with all my interest and passion. Then I had this scholarship when I was 18 to go to America. And I was, you know, really realizing the dream of a young jazz musician, because of course for me it was the music, it was the place where this music was born and where all these musicians that I've been listening to, they all lived there in America.
And there you started with Claire Fisher, right?
That's right. I found myself in it was called Blue Lake Fine Arts Camp, and I got actually, there was one scholarship offered for a guy from Yugoslavia, but there were like two conditions: that he should already play jazz and he should be not older than 18. There were not many guys corresponding to these two things in Yugoslavia, but now I was one of them. So basically that's how I got the thing, and I went there and it was, you know, it was a great thing. First of all, I replaced my American dream, in which we were all baiting because of the, you know, that's how the America makes publicity out of it, through it got this liberty, the land of possibilities message, mostly on the art communication, you know, music, mostly music, and whatever possibilities of instruments and those who were creating, and, you know, one idea, and you can really realize this only in America, you know, this kind of American dream. But then when I went there, I actually replaced it with American reality, which was completely different. You know, all these aspects that you do not see in American movies, but you see there, like racial segregation. That was like first time in my life that I realized that I cannot go out of the car. The guy told me, like, where are you crazy? Why are you opening the door? Well, I just want to go to see this music show.
No.
Don't you see where we are? And I said, no, where are we? Well, you don't see, it's like a black quarter of Detroit. Like, is it? So in 86, which was the year I was there, you are not supposed to go out because it's dangerous in the middle of the day for me as a white guy. And he was like, of course. You know, that's one of the discoveries that I made there. And as you can see here, we are in 2021.
And it has not changed.
Better, yeah. One damn bit.
Yeah.
You know, so this was one of the things that really put me on a big cold shower concerning the idea of living there. Studying, yeah, I mean, of course, I learned so much in these 3 months that I was there in 86, but I didn't feel like staying there.
Yeah.
And basically, I still had 1 year to end up my music school in Belgrade, and then I came back and I finished this year. And then what happened is, like, I already became recognized as a jazz pianist, not that much because I was so good, but mostly because there were not a lot of them. So I was just, you know, it was practical to have a young guy who was capable of playing okay. But what happened then is that very quickly I found myself, you know, especially when I came back from America, because it was like it gave me the wings, because I learned so much, and I saw that this music can touch the soul of the public of 3,000, not only 300 during the festival and 30 during the clubs, you know. So that kind of idea gave me the wish to, you know, try to operate and play this music while having the idea that it's quality music, so it should be touching the many people, not just, you know, happy few in the small clubs. And then what happened is that I became official piano player of big band radio television Belgrade, which, my friend, is like the maximum of your career, official career that you can make in what was back then in Belgrade, which was the capital of Yugoslavia. You know? So it was like I was 18 and I already should have told myself, well, that's it. You've made it. You've made it to the top.
What are you going to do the next 60 years?
No, don't tell me this. Yeah, yeah. It's just, you're just going down from age of 18. I don't know who said it was something. I think it's Joe Zawinul when they made him listen to Chick Corea's first album. And it was like a blindfold test. And he recognized there was Chick. I said, yeah, I like it. It's a nice album. I hope it will not be his best. His peak, yeah. Because then the rest of his life he will just go down, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, I really thought like it's not possible that this is it, you know. And I was right. But for this, I really needed to change the environment and find myself surrounded by the guys of same age, and who were going for this with the same passion as I was going. And I was not wrong, because when I came to France, well, that's exactly what I found. Found guys of my age and who already knew as much as I did about jazz, about rock, and you know, the music that touched our generation. And I always had this idea that if you gather with the guys of, you know, this generation power, that it makes sense. And I was lucky enough to find myself, you know, with the guys of the same age. And I still played with some of them, and we really definitely recognized the generation force that was, you know, and what we were listening to at the end of the 80s and throughout the 90s and everything, just, you know, discovering all these things together and analyzing and passing time together was the best way to get close and profound, make this music collaboration even more profound.
Yeah, I mean, yes, the generation thing makes sense, of course, because you know, you grow up at the same time, so you experience similar things, you know, and make similar experiences in many regards. And also, I think it also has something to do with how you feel.
Yeah, but, you know, it is something that you can observe in the history of the art and artists. You know, I think it was Brian Eno who said it in one interview that I watched a few years ago, and I really liked. Well, he's a wise man, and it's always good to listen to some of his observations. I mean, at least they do me good.
Same for me as well.
Sensitive to what this man has to say and his observations. And this one was very good, because it touched, you know, he said basically that we all think that somebody like Shostakovich, Bach, Picasso, that these guys were, you know, like born talents, and they just, wherever they were, they did all this, and then they went away, and they left all this body of creativity and the creation that we can just, you know, look at it and like go like, wow, what a genius he was. But actually, if you study their life, you see that most of them actually did make a move toward an environment in which they could flourish, and that will push out of them their potential. And this is a very important part for me. And this is actually why it was good for me to move out of Belgrade at that moment, because being in an environment where I was surrounded by other big artists, and not just, you know, imagining them from Belgrade and waiting for them to pass on these few festivals and the periods where there was something happening, even though it was not that little, but being here and being in a city where the idea of playing jazz was, you know, much more relaxed and not like scholar thing, like this is jazz and this is, you know, the rest is shit. Like, you know, I mean, this kind of apprenticeship that I had from older jazz musicians in Belgrade, not all of them, but some of them were very precise and still are about what is jazz and what is not jazz. At the period of being a teenager, it did serve me for something because, you know, I did understand why certain aspects are, you know, separated from the others. But it's like, you know, the idea of religion. If religion excludes something, all the other things that are not comprised in this religion, I'm not interested in it at all.
Yeah, because it's dogmatic. It's like different.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's supposed to be like a different aesthetic ways to come to the idea of a superior being. And we all have some idea about it. So, you know, Buddhism would be this aesthetic, Islam would be this aesthetic, Christianity and all its different paths would be this thing. And so most, you know, luckily there are all these aesthetics that pushed people from different parts of the planet to create all these things in awe in front of the idea of a supreme being, you know. So in the music, it's exactly the same thing. I mean, jazz is already something we can discuss for hours, like what exactly is jazz, you know. But being like, this is jazz and this is not jazz. Okay, but I don't recognize myself.
Kind of missing the point very much, right? Especially nowadays.
Well, yeah, because basically the most important thing in jazz, in what's called jazz, is the fact that it's the mixture of total different cultures.
Yeah.
Basically, you had like European music with all its beauty and complexity and everything that happened throughout the centuries until the 19th century. And then this music was approached by African slaves who were used on learning music just by listening to it. So that's basically the, you know, so. And it came like this, and somebody then, some journalist. And important thing is that it happened in the third neutral land, which was the land of the United States of America, you know, or Caribe Islands. That's where it really this sound generated. And then New Orleans, and through New Orleans went to, you know, something that made people dance, and it was a music that was soldable. You could sell it, you know. And then they put the label on it, jazz. But most of the jazz musicians, even when I was studying this music, and I mean, like Dizzy Gillespie, he never wanted to use this word, or he would use it, but he would always call it like American art form,
yeah,
which was not modest at all. But basically, it's true that if there was one clearly American art form that mixed European and African culture, well, that was it.
And also, if one listens to certain pieces of art created by, let's say, Charles Mingus or Miles Davis, or even Duke Ellington. I mean, you can, in some things, you can also find them having been influenced by, you know, the classical tradition as well. So,
well, it's not just this. You know, you pulled out really a very important names. You know, Miles was coming from a, you know, wealthy family. His father was dentist in St. Louis, as long as I know, and he had money to study in
Wasn't he at Juilliard in the beginning?
Juilliard, yeah.
Yeah.
Juilliard in New York, which was classical school. Like, you know, I studied in Mokranjac in Belgrade, so there was no jazz in it. But 20, 30 years before him, you had Duke Ellington. Duke Ellington definitely wanted to become, he was amazed by classical music.
Yeah, yeah.
And then somebody had to tell them, do you have a mirror at home, buddy?
Yeah, you're black.
Like, no, why? But look at the color of your skin. It's like, even today in 2021, if you look, like, there's not many musicians who really make a big career in classical music and being black, which is, it's crazy. I really thought like that it was a past, the story of the past. It's not. So back then, you can imagine, you know, that a black kid comes like, I wanted to learn classical music. Like, so I can just imagine what kind of a frustration it had to create inside of them, because they were touched by grace of all this beautiful music. So then they just had to create their own shit, which is exactly what they did. You know, if you listen to the suites of Duke Ellington, it's not jazz. It's not. It's a special music that he called jungle music, not because of jungle rhythm, because it's the organization of something super complex and vivid and with many details. But it works. And that's what why I think that he called it jungle music, you know, because it's like, wow, but it works as an organization. So yeah, Miles, it was the same thing. And, you know, they were all touched by the grace of European classical music composers. And it was impossible for them to even imagine that they will make a career as musicians
in classical world. Yeah.
So just they just had to invent their own thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so if we talk about creation or continue talking about it, I mean, you have published many albums as a leader, and it's starting with the album YNZ Quartet, which I think was in 93, and the last one until now being your second solo piano album called Soul Shelter from, I think, 2012. So in your discography, you use different settings and you work with many different musicians from different countries and cultural backgrounds. And, you know, to start discussing your body of work as a leader or composer, for me, I will point out the album Xenophonia from 2006. And for two reasons. Firstly, it was the first one I had the chance to listen to at all.
Okay.
Yeah. Because
yeah, why not?
Yeah, my friend Roman Babik, who's a piano player from Wuppertal, where I live, he gave it to me and he said, "Hey man, you have to listen to this. You will love it," because he knew, you know, he knew what music I was into. And secondly, you know, I mean, I have listened to it so many times and still I love to listen to it after all those years.
I mean, I'm really glad to hear this.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure. I didn't become insensitive to this. all the contrary. You know.
Yeah. And then also, I think this album has a very special vibe, you know, to it. Like, you know, the way how the compositions are written and then how it's performed and how it sounds, production, like everything, basically, you know. And one very, like, let's say, like one very crucial element of the sound you created is that you are, additionally to the grand piano, you are also using the Fender Rhodes piano on this album.
Yeah.
But you are not using it in the way as it's widely known and loved in, let's say, jazz or 70s funk music or pop music. And you found a new way, a unique way to use it by, you know, working with new ways to tune it using microtones. And also you worked a lot with the, you know, with distortion. And there are some songs where it almost sounds like an electric distorted rock guitar. This way it became like a whole new instrument, which is called the xenophone. And so how did you come to develop the xenophone, and what comes in mind for you when you think back of composing and recording this particular album?
All right, thanks for this question too, because it is a subject. And I still have a vivid and alive memory about most of these events and moments. So basically what happened is that it turned out, it all started by the idea that in 2003, I pulled out my Fender Rhodes that was in the garage, like most of them, for six years, and I was just looking at this black box and didn't pull it out since, because I was mostly playing acoustic piano. And then a friend of mine and a colleague that I worked with already for years, Julien Leroux, he told me, "No, I'd like to make an album, a project, but I would hear you play mostly keyboards and, you know, Fender Rhodes." I said, "You still have it?" I said, "Yeah, I do." And it was the one that I bought in Pančevo. It's close to Pančevo, like when I was a kid. It was like a gift if I finished the primary music school from my father. It was like a carrot, you know.
Good
like
one.
For a donkey to advance, he had Fender Rhodes in front. Well, that was a nice carrot, man. So, yeah, but I didn't use it for years. Then I took it out. It was like all, because there was like some inundations in garage. And it was like all green, the champignons. Like basically, I really had to clean it thoroughly and clean the oxidation and, you know, rust and everything. So I took it out, and while I was cleaning it, I kind of getting interested in mechanical part of feather rolls, and of course I loved the sounds and so on. And then while doing this, I heard, you know, that was the moment where in Belgrade you could find Fender Rhodes for like such a small money, because people are getting rid of it because it's taking a lot of place and nobody was using it. So I asked my brother if he could find me one. My brother was a guitar player. He died last year. That's why he was the boy. Sorry for this. And he basically, you know, he found a place and he thought, okay, next time you come to Belgrade, it's a wife of Lola, the bass player who just died. Oh man, Lola, I knew Lola, yeah. Well, you know, his wife, she's selling, and okay, then let's go there. So basically went there and I saw this woman who was, you know, her husband was legendary bass player in Belgrade, died, and she was, you know, he broke when he died. And she had two daughters. One of them was very nicely passionate about classical piano, and she gained a lot of prizes as a classical piano player. So basically I found my there, and then she opened this big place with instrument that she was selling to get some money. And there was like a half of Fender Rhodes with half pieces missing. But I was in a trap, because I was there, I saw that she needs money. And my brother was like, you see, it's a good deal I found for you. No, it was not a good deal for me. It was a good deal for her. But I didn't feel like you're not buying it.
You cannot just go walk away and say, oh, sorry. Yeah.
So basically I bought half keys of inside guts of Fender Rhodes without a box, without anything. And I paid like 300 euros, which was like, you know, for that money, you could find a real Fender Rhodes, you know, with everything. But I found myself, you know, yeah, okay, I'll help this woman out, and that's a good deed. So fuck it.
Yeah.
It's not a big, big, big thing for me. Like, this money was okay. But I really didn't come to have, you know, cheap Fender Rhodes. But it corresponded to the fact that I was already passionate by, you know, the mechanical side of it. So basically what I started doing is I was starting finding pieces, missing pieces on eBay.
Okay.
And then I found, you know, like, okay, missing pieces, and I bought all of them. But it was like kind of I had to reconstruct the Fender Rhodes, and I already had one. So basically I said, okay, this one is working okay, so I will have a normal Fender Rhodes. But what will I do? Maybe I can find some kind of a hybrid instrument. And I was already, you know, amazed by quarter notes that you could find in Turkish.
Or Arabic.
Makams and Arabic music and everything, you know. But I, doing it on the piano, well, no, because there's three strings to tune instead of one. And Fender Rhodes, you know, it's just one. So yeah, so basically I use this one to get these makams and, you know, see if I can do this on stage, because it's doable. To make long story short, if it's possible, I started, you know, constructing these things and putting the tines and everything. But then when I was doing it, I said, okay, I'm not going to try to make them sound even. I'm going to leave them in an odd way and see what it gives. And then, of course, detune them with this idea of having Eastern Arabic makam scales. And while doing it, well, it really turned out to have a very specific sound. And I even tried to, by fixing it, I really tried to approach the sound of Fender Rhodes more to Wurlitzer, because I realized that if you do it like this, oh, it gets this Wurlitzer sound. I mean, it was just the experimentation. And I really wanted to get out of this classical Herbie Hancock Fender Rhodes sound that everybody was running after. Nah, I mean, he did it. So let me try to do something else. And then I had, you know, I bought a you know, once you go in one direction, then all these little details and moments start mingling in. I found a guy that was making a preamp, which permitted me to take out the middle thing, and then suddenly approach to the guitar. And my brother is a guitar player, so he always, when as a kid, you know, as a guitar players had more success with girls because they had this phallus instrument and looking at them while we were looking at the keys and, you know, whatever. We were not that often in eye contact with girls.
I mean, I'm a bassist, so I know what you're talking about.
I know you know, but the people who are listening to us, maybe they don't. And basically, you know, that was one of the things. And I was, you know, one of my first instrument that I really took in the hands, and I had knowledge of guitar and distortion and all these things. And like I mentioned, there was, you know, I listened a lot to Smuk, the group from rock group from Serbia, and especially one album that I was witnessing, the last concert of this band, of the, you know, the which was happening in Tash in Kalemegdan Fortress in Belgrade, and it was the album called Zašto ne volim snijeg, Why Don't I Like the Snow, and basically it's more a guitarist album, Radomir Mihailović Točak. And on this album, this guy, actually, it was his brother died, and he was completely into dark mood, and he plays Stratocaster with microtones. And it was like my main inspiration is this album. And then I realized that, you know, I can get these things from, you know, these notes on Fender Rhodes. And with this preamp, I could get really close to the attack of the guitar just by pulling out the middles, because there were already a lot of examples from Chick Corea and other guys where they played Fender Rhodes with distortion, but they would not go as deep as me in frequency things. They would just, you know, put distortion because the amp they had distortion, so they just played like this. And I really made a bit more research about it, and that's how I came to this thing. And then I was observing the reactions when you play a keyboard with these makams and notes, and people were like, "Oh." So it looked like, you know, strange, strangerphone. And it was a word game that came for all this thing, but it started from the instrument. It was like, you know, xenophone, strangerphone. And well, hey, xenophonia. And that gave actually the birth to the... And then I realized that I'm about to be in France 20 years, which is the same period. I'm about to cross the period that I was abroad, or I was not in my home country. I left when I was 20, and it was 20 years that I was in France. It was like a good period where I realized that I'm a professional stranger.
Yeah.
I was already treated as a stranger in Belgrade because I was so long not there. He's maybe from here, but he's not one of us. And here I was still treated as, he's not French. So professional stranger. So all these things came like, you know, in the place, and that's exactly what I tried to pull out in this album. Now, composition-wise, well, it was all the ideas that I had at that moment. You know, the first tune called Opener, I think, or Ulaz.
Yeah, Ulaz, yeah, the intro.
Basically, nobody knew that we were recording. It's a sound check.
Yeah, you just jammed.
We just jammed, but I did get in deal with the sound engineer. Like, I'd look at him like, turn it on. I didn't want them to, you know, the other musicians to know. Because basically when you know that it's recording, you get all serious. And actually it's very often the best energy you can find is during the sound checks before the concerts. Because everybody's relaxed. Everybody thinks like, oh, yeah, more bass in my monitor. Yeah. But the way the music is played is like exactly the way it should be. So this idea I started, you know, using on Xenophonia, using the tunes where people were not thinking about the fact that it was recording. And that's one of the techniques that was used on it, several tunes. And then there was this mixing of acoustic and electric thing that was present. And it was the moment where I learned how to use Pro Tools too, which permitted me, you know, to sit at home and opened the session. It was back in 2005, so quite some time ago. And I think I was one of the first jazz musicians here to get interested in this aspect. Because, you know, it was young musicians that were already into DAW, while you know, jazz guys, they would always leave it to the sound guys, but it was like costly, you know? So I learned how to listen to all the, you know, the tracks, and then I was listening to the sound of that mic that stayed open and it was not used, and said, oh, this gives a nice room. And actually I kind of was getting into sound architecture of the album. Then when I went to mix with my sound engineer, Philippe Tessier-Ducrot, I had a pretty precise idea of what we should, you know,
have. What you want to go for. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, and I'm very glad to hear, and I heard quite a lot of people who have this as a very positive reference as a piano trio and as an album with a concept in sound. And even Nagara, because it was mastering was done from Nagara to through analog cable and then back to digital. So Nagara uses this album for the demonstration of its machines, and I'm, you know, very proud of this fact. There you go. I think I answered your question. My answers are long, man.
No, but it's cool.
It's the fault of your questions.
Yeah, I mean, but this is actually what this show of mine, this little show, is about. I don't want to, you know, I don't think it's like our responsibility to pay attention to the fact that the attention span of people is, you know, so low. So the answers are as long as they need to be, and it's cool.
Okay. I hope they're interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah, maybe if we talk about the album Soul Shelter for a little bit. Like I mentioned earlier, it's from 2012, and I think it's your second solo piano recording, yeah. Right? Yeah, and also for me, very fascinating, and this album I really love too, since you sent it to me several years back. And, you know, and this, of course, one very special thing about it is that it's only you playing, and you're not accompanied by anybody else. But then also when we listen to the music and the compositions, there's a lot of musical influences coming together, like obviously jazz or black music in the brightest sense, but then traditional, classical. And you also use the piano in many different ways. For instance, there's songs where you also play grooves and beats in the way like a drummer would do, you know, and like to sum it up, it's a very special album. And I still love to listen to it. And so the question would be, like, you know, how is your approach when you compose or when you plan a production like this where it's only you, as opposed to composing for like a trio or like a band with even more musicians?
Since I started recording my own albums, I think I was never pushed by, you know, producer like, okay, this year you have to do three of them. Then you have, you know. No, I was mostly doing albums when I had something to say. I didn't, you know, as I approach my career, I mean, I'm not somebody who's really running after it and running after the crowd and likes and stuff like this. I mean, I just think that it's which is making it quite hard existence in nowadays, because everybody's, you know, it became almost like accepted thing that if you have a lot of likes, well, you are somebody important for the arts. If you don't have, well, fuck you. You are just, you know, you think you're big, but you ain't important because the people are not going after you.
Yeah.
But whatever. I still think that I'm trying to do my best, and that's it. You know? And I'm not trying to do my best by learning new techniques of selling on and presenting myself as somebody who is important and running after the likes and the crowd. But apparently I'll have to learn something about it, because you don't have to use these means, because I don't think there will be a going back to my old habits and the old habits of the way artists were communicating with the public. Now everybody's artist and everybody can communicate to their public.
Yeah.
So whatever. But to come back on your question, which was a Soul Shelter. So yeah, when it came to Soul Shelter, it was the moment when I felt I had something to say. You know, I didn't do the album since 2009, I think, which was the one before. So like 4 years. And actually, always there were like several years passing by because I needed to have a life experience
to have something to
tell.
Worked
on my, you know, inspiration. Mm. And then I would say, okay, this maybe would be something original to put, you know, that has reason to be stopped on the sound support. So basically that's how it happened. You know, I had an idea of going and record in Italy, in Fazioli, which is, they're my favorite pianos since 97, that I think I used on most of my recordings, always Fazioli pianos. But then I wanted to go further by recording in their concert hall, which was the start of the idea. And then I realized that, you know, that basically I was in a hard period of writing music. And it was like one of the first moments that I really lost my wish to communicate beauty and aesthetics to the people because of the world was going in such a shitty direction. And then I realized that it's a trap, you know, because I was still following news and I've, you know, after all these wars and instead of becoming better, well, it basically did not. So then I said, well, I think I will stop, isolate myself in a, you know, instead of looking inspiration from outside, let me see if there is still something going inside here. So I kind of, you know, turned towards myself and closed myself here in the countryside. And basically turned out all the mainstream medias, mostly TVs and radios and stuff like this. And I really stopped following these things. And yeah, there were some things to say, but, you know, coming out of the clearness of my inner soul. And that's where the title comes from. You know, Soul Shelter is like, you know, I had to isolate myself and just to get out of my primary wish to communicate aesthetics, which is still very alive, but I should not wait from the outside world to give me reasons to do it, you know.
You have to cut out the noise.
Exactly. And the noise and the nonsense, you know, it's just this. But yeah, it's still as hard to want to go out. And this is actually one of the main reasons why I still didn't record since this album, and we're coming almost to 10 years, not because I was not creative, but really I had no energy to confront everything that needs to be confronted in order to release an album in a do quality and the label and everything. Because in the meantime, this world really exploded completely. So yeah, I'm just slowly now coming to a point where I think that it would be nice to document at least the creativity that I had throughout these past years and what's happening in my mind right now. So I think I'll work on it anyhow and pull out the albums, or maybe not the albums anyhow. The music will be released. The recording music will be released. In which form, I don't know. I'm about to see.
Yeah, but on the Soul Shelter album, I mean, like I said, I really love it and I listen to it a lot, very often.
Thank you.
But one song which really, you know, struck me in a particular way is the opening song, Full Half Moon. And I mean, I don't even know how to describe why it, you know, why it took me so much on the emotional level. But what is the story behind this particular
the
song?
The story is... basically, it's a tune dedicated to Sarajevo. So I think.
Why.
Then I think it might touch you in a very specific way. You know, Sarajevo is a place where the biggest amount of my family comes from, on my mother's and father's side. And I was going there as a kid, you know, since I was born. I spent like months in Sarajevo with the different members of my family. And this is a town and the energy that I know since, you know, beginning of 70s until the beginning of the war. And then I skipped the war years because I was much more useful being in France than being there and I was more useful even for the people who were in Sarajevo from that other position, instead of having them worry about me plus all the rest. So, and then I went back to Sarajevo when Edin Zubcic invited me to play there, like, which was in 99, first time, which 2 years after the grenades stopped falling.
Yeah, he started his festival very early after the war.
Yeah. It's like he got out of the cave, dust off, and I want to do a jazz festival.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
But that's why I like him a lot, because he's enough crazy to do what his soul tells him to do, in spite of the fact that it will cost him his life. But what I want to say is that, you know, I had already, you know, one of the things, I remember one particular moment, I was visiting my family. I think it was one of the years when I played there, because beginning of November. And actually, as now, all the religious feasts are celebrated by this groupation, which is in Sarajevo. So it was, what happened is, it was like All Saints. I think it was like 1st or 2nd November. And I was at my mother's aunt's place, and she had a flat that really had a beautiful view on Trebević. It's like, you know, close to the center, but a bit from the heights. And I got out on the terrace, and I realized that there was an amazing thing happening. There were bells of the church because of All Saints, and it was in B flat. Do, 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 do. So this, and at the same time, that was a Muslim prayer ezan from a mosque, but the guy was doing it on B flat.
Yeah.
Man, that was, and I think I have somewhere this recording. It was so good. You know, that music still, see what I mean?
Still there combined.
Yeah. So that was one of the first things, like, oh man, this city is a crazy place, you know, with all these energies and contradictions and miseries and everything. And the fact that, you know, like many other places, that these people, they permit themselves to be driven by political idiots who just steal the money and
get, yeah, it's fucking
themselves
sad
up. I mean, in France, it's the same thing, unfortunately. That's why I try to avoid these people as much as I can.
Yeah.
But anyhow, and this world. Because it's, so this was the beginning of the idea. Then I had these elements of, you know, this chorale, da, 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 which is more like classical music. But then this leading into, which is definitely something oriental. And like all this idea of trying to make some music that will have all these elements of different aesthetics, and always trying to make some logic in, you know, not like parallel worlds, not like, you know, the world music that is done by, like, you take the Eskimo singer and you
a
put
a little bit of this, a little bit of that.
Yeah, a little bit of this, a little bit of that. Just, and always a steady beat.
Yeah.
You know, and then it's, you know. No, I like doing it in a different way. So basically, I had all these elements. And then I was in Sarajevo, invited by Edo to work with Damir Imamović and Erik Vloimans and Bashar Khalife. It was like one of the tries out to make a band on the festival that Edin created, and he called it Xenophonia as my album. But it was like lasting only 2 years or 3 years, because it was like too much. Sarajevo could not follow that, you know, another festival that was a bit too close to jazz. Whatever, Edin could tell you a bit more about why it stopped. But it was, I remember we were having this rehearsal, and I was trying to get this tune for this project. And during the rehearsal, it's, you know, like Tetris, it started making sense, and all these parts that were separated, that they started, and they got together. I said, oh, I see how to, you know, construct this tune, and it's going to be great. And we got out of the BKC, Bosnian Cultural Center, where the restaurant was, you know, close to Miljatska. And I remember we got out and I looked, man, and there was this huge big moon. And of course, at the same time, there was Ezan, you know, the Muslim prayer ringing over the city. And I had the title.
Yeah. Yeah.
Full half moon, because that's exactly what it was, you know, like half moon being a symbol of Islam. Do you know why a star and a half moon are the symbols of Islam?
To be honest, I don't.
It's very simple. It's not, you know, I mean, it became a sign that is supposed to make the Western world be afraid, because when you see the sign, well, soon it's going to be a big boom, you know, and many people will die. But basically, it's because the calendar in Islam is counted by moon cycles.
Moon cycles, yeah. Yeah, okay.
Ciao, bye-bye. That's the reason.
Yeah.
And all the rest is interpretation.
Yeah, but wonderful. I mean, from this song, there have been several versions.
Oh, there's a new one coming out in March. I didn't let this thing go.
Oh.
Yeah, I produced a Michel Portal album, and I think this one will be the most orchestrated, blah, blah, blah. I mean, cool. And a different arrangement than I did on the other ones. But I'm pretty happy about this one. You know? So, yeah, there is one on Nenad Vasilić album, and I did this solo, and I played it with Julien as well, a duo. But it turned out that, you know, it ended up on this album. But you'll hear it when it will be released. I'll send you the album.
Cool. Yeah, it's really wonderful. Actually, I had the plan, which I never came to realize. I wanted to record a version of it with bass, you know, with different bass voices.
Man, if you need any help, like, you know, a sheet music or things like this, I'll be glad to send it to you.
Yeah, thank you. I really have been this idea in 4 years.
Well, could sound great, man. Of course, as overdubbing.
Yeah, exactly. I could imagine, but it's very challenging, so I didn't dare to do it yet.
Whenever you get the moment, just let me know.
Okay, cool. So maybe if we could talk a little bit about musicians, let's say. If I'm informed correctly, you have a trio, which is for a very long time consisting of the double bassist Tomas Brameri. I hope I'm pronouncing the name right.
Yeah, good.
And the drummer Martijn Fink.
Yeah.
And so especially in jazz context, it's like not that often that a group of musicians really plays together for a very long time, you know. So what is it that makes you want to play with Tomas and Martijn for so long? And the second question is like, which particular qualities or characteristics are you looking for when you choose musicians for your projects?
Okay. So I was laughing while you were saying the first question, because actually it's true that we are playing together since already 10 years, but there's another detail. We never recorded with this trio.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But that's because of my specific relation to the idea of making an album. I need to have a team that I feel good with, you know, and it was not the case in the last years. But so that's the first thing. And why I play with them, because, I mean, they have all the qualities that I would need in the idea of, you know, jazz idiom plus openings, drummer and bassist. First, they like playing with each other. Martijn likes playing with Toma, and Toma likes playing with Martijn. And for me, as a, you know, then I have what you call a killing rhythm section for me as a pianist. And simply, Martijn is, you know, a very musical soul, and he plays this instrument in a way that corresponds to me and my sense of groove and elegance. And same counts for Toma. But the fact is, like, you know, with all these moments that we live now, it's like I had concerts that were postponed by them already for, you know, third time. And I haven't been playing with them for way too long. And I miss them, you know, because this is how you keep on advancing the musicianship, is by playing, you know, concerts.
Yeah, being together, spending time together.
Exactly. Playing,
talking, everything.
Exactly. So that's, you know, the personal qualities is definitely one of the things that I look for in my choice of musicians. Means they should be nice people to be with. If they're, you know, assholes and problematic people in the sense that they just look for the problems for the sake of looking for the problems or making tension, then I will not go for them, even if they're great, great players. Because I learned this from Boško Petrović back in Grozny in my first jazz course. But when he said, you know, Beba, it's very important to know who you are working with, because concert lasts for 1 hour and then you have 23 hours left to be with an asshole. And it's, he was fucking right, you know, because, you know, we spent so much time together that, you know, and I've been in situations where the guys weren't really making things complicated for no reason whatsoever because of their personal problems and stuff like this. And it's very hard.
Especially if you go on a long tour. That's the latest one where you will find out how much of a drag it can be, and it leads to nothing being fun anymore.
So most of the musicians that I play with are you know chosen, of course, on their musical talents, but as well as the people that I'd like to present myself with and to travel with and to live with, you know. And that makes things a bit more complicated, you know, because great musicians, there are, you know, a lot of them. But then it should be a match as well on the personal level. So, yeah, well, that's why I'm not changing very often the musicians that I play with, even though I like trying new things and new people and crossing my energies with other guys. And I'm still doing it quite a lot. But once I find something that works, well, I'm not afraid of going extra miles with these people. You know, if you take somebody like Amira Medunjanin, it's the same thing. You know, we worked together already for quite some times, and it's still pleasure because humanly amongst us there is an understanding, you know.
Yeah, that would have actually have been my next question anyway, you know.
You see?
Because
anticipation.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, you have, of course, done lots of work as a sideman too, which we could also talk about this for an hour because there's so many interesting corporations and albums in that regard. But you also work as a producer, and most notably, it was in the last couple of years, at least, in that regard, it was the albums you did with Amira. And it's not just the albums, but you also play live together, you go on the road together. And this is very special in the way that obviously she's wonderful. She's a wonderful and very unique singer. And she is rooted in the Bosnian Sevdah music. But additionally to Sevdah, she also allows herself the freedom, which I really love, to sing, basically sing songs from all over what used to be Yugoslavia. So she sings Serbian songs, Macedonian songs.
Well, that's her first problem, you know. That's one of the things that makes her, especially back home in Sarajevo, she's looked like, you know, somebody who's not respecting the tradition, you know. But that's their problem because the best way for me, of keeping the tradition is be aware of it. Definitely, that's the first thing. But then, you know, open up the thing, you know, because you cannot define Sevdah is not Bosnian.
It's not just
frontiers are invented by humans, by political moments in history.
Yeah.
The music can correspond to certain geographical place, but the feeling and the emotion that is at the back of it, you can find it as well in Macedonian music, in Serbian music, in Bosnian music, in, you know, and that's what this propos and the message that we have by working together with Amira is this. Of course, she knows very well Bosnian stars and stars of Sevdah and big creators of this music. But whatever, I mean, I think she called me with idea that they should be opened and, you know, with all due respect to the tradition. But I'm not going to sing like and play with accordion and violin and exactly the same instruments that were then, because simply it's not my job. There are other guys who still can
has been done already.
The sound. Yeah, and of course. And, you know, most of the... I recently listened to, another project that was done already quite some time ago. It was Amar Cesler, you know, he did this band with Maria Šestić was singing, and there's an entire concert to listen to. And that's, for me...
I watched it a couple of times.
You agree with me that's really pretty much different than what we did with Amira, but yes. It has it's a great attempt, and not just attempt, but it's like enough artistic challenging project, and it's pity that they didn't push this to some kind of a recording of the album.
I absolutely agree, because I stumbled upon it sometime. I don't know, like at night when I check out things on YouTube.
You see, but you agree with me, because it's like not at all the same kind of a approach to it, because it keeps more traditional thing in, but then they have ideas of bringing it in a different way, and it makes sense, and it makes, and it's like artistic statement in front of the public that heard the melodies, they know, sang, and musicianed in a way that still corresponds to the idea of Sevdah, but just put in some kind of a more modern light that made sense, because you can as well make big mistakes and taste errors by doing this, which is okay too, But for me, that was a good example. And I don't think I told this to Amar nor to Maria, but I better do.
Like you said, when you compare it to what you do with Amira, it's very different, but this... but it has its value at the, and this shows how how diverse the music is.
Yeah. And most of the tunes they played on this concert, I didn't know them. Most of the tunes, so that means that they were digging, not just taking like those that everybody sings, like the first ones that would be sang in the restaurants, but. A bit more research, which is one of the things that we were doing as well with Amira, who is pretty good as an internet digger herself.
I listened to the albums, and then also there was an album, a live album, I think it was from Zagreb, right?
Where, the live album is from Arena, from Pula.
From Pula, yeah. Where there's also like not just you guys and the band you had with Nenad on bass, but there's also an orchestra. So you even expanded in that direction.
Well, if we talk about DVD, the DVD is not with Nenad. It's already with Zvonimir Šestak and Ante Gelo. But it's with the Trondheim Solisten Orchestra. This is the band that was filmed and released by Croatia Records. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, something like this. But there are recordings of the concerts with Nenad and Zagrebački Solisti from Zagreb. So maybe you're just mixing this.
So I'm mixing it up, yeah.
Okay, but anyhow, this body of work with... and it became, I think... I guess for a singer, it's a consecration of the career when you end up singing with a, symphony orchestra or strings orchestra at the back. It's something big, and Ante is a well known. Ante Gelo is quite well known in Croatia as the guy who writes arrangements for orchestras. He studied this matter in Graz, I guess, and he developed it a lot. So yeah, so Ante started writing the arrangements for her, and then actually we mixed this thing once we had a concert with the Dubrovnik Symphony Orchestra in Dubrovnik, and that's where I found myself writing certain things for the first time in my life, and asking Ante quite some advices and stuff like this. But that's it ended up on the album called Ascension, I think, Ascending, and that's where we recorded this music with the Trondheim Solist string orchestra.
If we just for a second go back to what we have been talking about earlier, like her as a singer choosing to, you know, to sing just songs which move her soul and touch her, and not paying attention to, is it a Bosnian song, is it from whatever, from Macedonia, I don't know. But when I, like for me as a listener, you know, when I listen to an album, like for instance the first one, Amulet, or also what followed, for me it sounds like one.
Well, that's how I took the job that was offered to me as a producer, because these criteria are already something that I used in my own music when I was mixing Balkan and jazz idiom. So basically, it definitely sent me back to, you know, my first album. I did the version of Grano Bora, and that was what Amira loved. And when she heard, you know, she knew my album before we started working together, and that's why she contacted me. It was proposed by Edin Zucic at the beginning, but of course she was already imagining that it would be great to find herself working with me. And then what matched the most is, you know, for me it's in spite of the music, you know, very often I don't have that much to do as a piano player, and then very often I'm laying out and just being there, or if it's duo then I have everything to do. But basically, for me, there is something else in as a mission in what I do with Amira. And it's, you know, this story of South Slavic tribes shooting each other and killing each other. And then when you put them in front of the music, they all cry at the same moment, you know, yeah. of the song.
Yeah.
How different are we? Oh, oh, oh. So that's for me the main reason why we already go left and right and we play all these concerts back and forth, because, you know, the way simply her voice touches the people's soul, and it's exactly the same moments that it touches Slovenian soul and Macedonian soul. So, you know, sorry, guys, but if I need something to prove me that we are not impossibly different, which makes our coexistence impossible, well, sorry, this is political bullshit, and at the back is something completely different.
Yeah, yeah.
That I would not put the word on, I'll let the others do it, you know, but for me it's, you know. And me coming, you know, from a mixed Bosnian-Serbian, being born in Belgrade, having Bojan and Zulfikar Pašić and all these things, like, so what? It makes just I'm a perfect client to do these kind of things, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
With conviction.
Yeah, yeah, and because basically in the end, that's what we, no matter which way you try to approach it, that's where all of us will end up anyway, realizing that we are the same. And there's no
difference. Earlier we realize it, better it will be for the quality of life that we will have. And better it will be for the others.
Yes, definitely. As we already mentioned before, you know, we are living in a time right now where we are very much surrounded by negativity and lots of fear, which is created by politics, media, you name it. And there's also lots of distraction going on everywhere, like with the phones and being bombarded by advertisements, by what, I don't know, like whatever. And so it can be quite challenging, you know, to keep up optimism and positive thinking. So
very much so.
Yeah, so you know, how would be your perspective?
Well, it is a trap. It is a trap. This one is a big one because, you know, concerning the artists and the stage people, we are forbidden to work. Or we are put in front of a very delicate situation, which is we should do it from home for free. And that's a big danger for me from the very beginning when I saw people running in front of their screens and doing, you know, playing and practicing and everything. I mean, you know, people already were not paying for the record, you know, for records, not buying recorded music anymore, which was one of the main incomes besides the stage that we have. And now we are deprived of existence means by not being able to work. And then the thing we will do, like, we owe something to our public. So let's do, we will make you go through these difficult times. They're fucking difficult for us too, even more than for them. Most of the people that work in other fields, they got paid and they continue working. And for me, it's like, you know, 1 year without being able to earn money. And it's not something that it is taboo for me, not at all. Like, guys, I'll be having to sell out the gear that I'm using for making music, you know, and it's a serious situation. So, you know, it's not something that should be not spoken of because, well, how come? Well, then it's your fault because you didn't get rich while you could. Get off of it, you know. It is a real problem. But behind all this, it's not, the trap is exactly this, that I start speaking about it and then you feel only the hatred coming out of my, or the frustration coming out of my being. It's not the case. I'm still, you know, pretty much, because I know that it's a trap. But I feel like having to express myself about it, but it doesn't really touch my basic motors in life, which is love for art and wanting to communicate this to a big number of people, you know, that surround me. Because I do this, it seems that I'm doing this pretty good, and people are always asking me when will I, you know, they tell me that they miss me on stage and playing music for them. So I really hope that this will come to an end as soon as possible. And then if we have to start everything from the scratch, well, that's something I already have done several times in life. And that's something that most of the politicians, they will never understand. Because if once one event would make them be paid 200 euros less, they would make a scandal out of it. And man, hey, for 1 year, I'm not, you know, I cannot earn, and I still, I'm alive, and I'm, you know.
And well, yeah.
Kind of, yeah, because I'm learned, and I learned how to deal with periods when there is no work and no money entering.
Yeah, that's what I thought for myself in the beginning when it all started. And as you said earlier, you know, here we all thought also, you know, this maybe will be going on for like a couple of months and then we will go back to what we used to. But when it became apparent that this is not the case, I just said, like, you know, there's like, if I think back to my life, in the past, there have been worse situations.
Well, in human history, it's enough to just imagine for the generation of my grandparents who lived through First World War and Second World War. So, yeah, that's a bit different situation. Then I have to sit at home and look at the screens, all the screens that I have and my machines. You know, yeah, but. The thing that was not happening back then is all these predator behavior coming from the filthy rich ones, you know, who wanted to apparently, they dream of having it all, you know, this plan being theirs and our lives in their hands. So that didn't exist as clear as it does today. Because, you know, I remember just like mid-April while we were still tripping from our living rooms and looking at the sky, like, you know, there's no planes up there. And then suddenly there was these lines of white points flying in the sky. And, you know, I remember people like, what the heck is this? Oh, this company called Skylink. What's Skylink? In the middle of lockdown? Oh, no, it's satellites for, you know, 5G. Oh, good. Well, and who's the owner? What, Skylink? Who's the owner? Whose companies? Oh, it's Elon Musk.
Okay, so then you know.
So we're locked down, and we are not able to go out or not even think about it. But there are those who can do whatever they want during this time. And of course, this guy is like the richest person on earth since 1 month. He went in front of the Jeff Bezos and stuff. I mean, I'm sorry even to speak about these guys because they're so unimportant for me, but I'm not a stupid guy who doesn't see all these things. And this is like, you know, okay, so there are guys who are stronger than the the countries and richer than the countries. And that's actually the biggest problem that defines nowadays the planet, is that you have few guys who have so much money that they can sue countries who don't want to do the things that they would like them to do. And then we are at the end of the list. Then we have the lying politicians who actually depend on these guys. And then they lie to us that, you know, they take care of everything, that they are the deciders. No, you're not. You know, Emmanuel Macron is as small as any other politician compared to these guys. But he's a big liar, because then he tells us the lies because he works for them. I mean, I don't have to be very clever to see these things as clear as I do. So, yeah. But you see, all this thing really definitely goes into people even listening to me that go like, oh, we are going to die. This is a horrible world we're living in. No, but it is a moment where you better understand what's going on in order to know who you want to turn to and where you want to stream your own energy and your own creativity, and who shall pay for our existence. Because I'm not modest about importance of art in human world. I mean, it is super important. And I know it, because I've been on the side of somebody who was receiving art, and still am. And it changed my life and opened up my mind and saved my life for so many times in this small existence of mine. As Rambo Amadeus says, in my long and poor career. And on the other hand, I've seen people around me having the same phenomena of being different people after one concert of music or after one exposition of paintings.
And yeah,
completely changes their way of seeing the world, and always for better. So I'm not going to pretend that this is not, as they call it now, only the first necessities will be open. Fuck you. Who the fuck you think you are to tell me what the first necessities are and what first necessities are not? And of course, for most of the people, art is dealt as like not first necessity. How wrong they are, the future will tell.
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely.
For me, they're very wrong.
Yeah, definitely.
Therefore, there is like more suicides last month in Japan than dead of COVID.
Yeah, one just needs to imagine how it would be when like every musician and artist would just say, okay, from now on, we are not doing anything.
Yeah, I can go into, you know, pick the grapes and do the wine job, help the wineries, because this is one of my passions. I can, you know, work in some kitchen as a assistant to a chef, because I like cooking as well. So yeah, whatever. I mean, I'll find some means of survival. But I think, I mean, the thing I still do the best is play music on stage. You know, so it would be a bit silly that because of the bad decisions made by idiots that we all have to stop doing it. You know. We have to open up our mouths much more than we have been doing until now. Because this is simply not possible, that the idiots, total fucking idiots, who work, who don't have, you know, they just want to protect themselves in front of the insurances. That's why we don't understand their measures at all. Because there's no logic in continuing keeping the restaurant, bars and concert halls closed if it's continuing. If pandemic is continued because of things that were open, and it means public transport, offices and schools, fuck off. And then they continue keeping us closed, and this open as the conclusion. Like, this is really like, treating us as an idiot, which I'm sorry, I cannot recognize myself. So yeah, but then again, you see, it's all going in some kind of I'm pretty much frustrated by the position that we are in now. Just because I have to let these idiots do what they're doing to us. That makes frustrations, yes, and obvious ones. But at the back of this, I'm still a very positive, creative, and you see what I mean. I love doing this as much as I did like doing it before. But we need to liberate our energies now.
One domain you are also very much involved in is music education. And of course, this could be a topic for a whole episode as well. You know, we could talk about it in a long for a long time. But maybe just like to go to it a little bit. When you teach, which you like to do, as I know,
I did it yesterday for 4 hours, so it's pretty fresh in my mind.
Yeah. So, but what like in a general sense, you know, what are you trying to transcend to your students? And if you would be asked to give an advice to young and aspiring musicians, what would it be?
Well, first, the reason why I like doing it, because it's the logical consequence of receiving. I received advices, I received from every concert that I was witnessing, there was always this pedagogical dimension to it as well. In every encounter I did with musicians, active musicians since I was a kid, and any kind of, not just jazz, but in jazz there is definitely this pedagogy thing, much more than just, you know, lighting up the thing and singing the songs as you do in the rock concerts. And I passed from the guy who was amazed by this music to a guy that was on stage, and I recognized the same looks that I had when I looked at the great guys, and I recognized some looks that people were looking at me like this. Because the thing that comes with this recognition is kind of a responsibility that you do have as an artist. So basically, I liked this thing. I think I already mentioned this to you, but I like this idea, which for me is the heritage from Africa that you find in jazz education, that you observe, just observing the master and you being clearly positioned as a young, as a pupil that wants to learn something. I mean, I'm still positioned like this when I work with Michel Portal. All these, you know, I worked with Texier, Henry Texier, Jack DeJohnette, you know, Scott. I mean, all these guys who were there like years and years before me doing this thing, I'll have until the end of their lives, in my life, I'll have things to learn. So I'm still more than lucid, you know, and I know that I can still learn so much from them. And I'm aware of the fact that I already have an experience where I can teach somebody else, and I'm very relaxed in this position. I have nothing to prove to somebody, so it's not about me when I teach somebody. It is about knowing where this student or young man, woman is standing, so that I can give them from that point of view something on a good level, which is just above their actual level. So that's you know, it's a big pleasure for me when I manage to match, to find exactly what to tell them on the level that is right above their expectancy and their actual level. And that's you know, something that is linked to experience and intelligence, not to be modest. And these are two qualities that as an educator you need to have. And of course, wish to share, and this is intact.
This is very crucial.
I mean, of course, and the trust that these young people will become the messengers of arts in the future. So you better tell them the real deal and the real things, which is, help yourself knowing what happened before you as much as you can, because it will give you the closer to the source you are in music or any other art, bigger will be your energy and longer it will keep you in your own creative lifespan. So know everything about, if it's about jazz, well, know everything that happened before. I know it's a big body of knowledge to know, to discover, but yeah, you have a lifetime to do it. but be methodic in it, because it will all help you just last longer. And don't think that it all starts and ends with yourself, while still keeping a lot of self-confidence, which is definitely very important in the fact that you are supposed to create, be a creator yourself. And so it's a complex way of complex existence, especially nowadays where distracting matters are all over us. You know, one of them being just simply this. You know, this thing is like, you know, it's instant gratitude, instant, you know, you're just open and you press, oh, it's interesting, I'll check what the others are doing, or playing a video game and everything. I mean, like for the kids, it's so much easier to feel some gratitude or something is happening by taking a phone than studying an instrument.
You know, like I have experienced, like, because sometimes when I travel to gigs on my own, I take the train when it's inside Germany. And so I've experienced things, you know, like I think with little kids, with really little kids, the aspect of addiction towards it is much, much higher and much more intense than with us. And with us, like, it's already fucked up.
Yeah, with us too. If you don't, you know, I have to make the moments where I go out for a walk and not take my phone, and I feel bad. Like
I will miss out on something.
No, you will enjoy your walk 10 times more instead of
Because you will really notice what's around.
So with the kids, it's like cocaine. It's really like being a dope.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Dependent.
I've noticed. I remember one situation on a train where, you know, there was a little kid, maybe like 3, and the parents were trying to take it away from him. You know. The phone, but it was I was really, I mean, that was something which made an impression, which lasted for a very long time.
I know, man. I know. I had similar experiences on a lower level than this, but you know, still there with my own kids. It's like, you know, wow. The moment we finally introduced the screens and the personal gadgets with screen and means of going and communicate with the World Wide Web, it was a beginning of problems and fights, or we're, you know, trying to tell them that this should be used a certain amount of time, not all the time. But yeah, then you say we can observe ourselves being hooked to it. So yeah, that's, well, at least something I try to turn out when I'm working music. Because you need concentration.
You need to be in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
But as we are, I would say, approaching the end of our beautiful conversation today, of course, you know, the guest shall have the final word, if you like.
Final thing is definitely, like I said, we should not think that we are, you know, we as an artists and our existence and importance in the society is much bigger than the actual times are trying to show us. There is a lot of work if you really want to be somebody who's aware of what happened before in order to be inspired and fit enough not to recreate something that was already done, but go further with the creation. But it's the best thing you can offer to yourself. And I'll eventually end up by, you know, each one of us, we are different, and our quest and our sense of aesthetics and our taste for what is a good balance of elements in artistic statement is different. And that's exactly what this life needs. It needs more and more of people who are original, who go for the way they are, and they try to affirm and confirm their own visions as something that is valuable in a human society. So that's my biggest message, is like, people do give you the means of advancing as an artist and gratify the human beings by your own vision of what is beautiful and aesthetics, because that's the soul food for all of us.
You have been listening to Talking Spirits Podcast, episode number 16, with Bojan Zulfikar Pašić and Armin Alić. Next week's episode will be one in German language once again, and my guest is one of my absolute bass heroes, German first call bassist Klaus Fischer. It looks like we have finally made it through winter time, so things will get better and easier for the months to come. Stay healthy and safe, and see you again next week.